Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Okay, I think I finished shuffling around my microphone and books that it sits on and everything else like that. It's too bad I live in a country where I have to title my show, I Can't Tell You Until You Listen to the Show. Okay, so this is where we are right now. This is where we stand in this country. My title today, CDC Whistleblower Says, and then I have to say, sorry, you'll have to listen to the show. And the reason I have to say that is because if I post exactly what the whistleblower said, that somewhere around 45,000 or possibly more people have actually died from the COVID vaccine and are being drastically underreported by the CDC, that's going to get immediately canceled. I'll be off for 30 more days. And even though it's sworn to by an affidavit, and even though I do believe it to be true because it makes sense based on what I've read, that but I can't say it. I can't say that, so I have to say it here. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say it here. So this is why you need to share the show. So if you want to get the word out, and this is what's fascinating. Alternatives are popping up everywhere to the news. So when I have a Dr. Peter McCullough video, or I have something, I've got sent some the latest election correction information. You know, there are videos all over the place about the fraud. More and more people know about the fraud. More and more people believe that this is exactly what happened. They're now kicking and screaming. You know, this is probably one of the most fascinating times in our history. Other than I think Watergate was an interesting time, but this is worse. this is so far. Watergate's like the before dinner drink, and this is the main course, you know. So this is what's going on out there, and it's fascinating that the conspirators, the social media, are anything but social, because if they were social, they'd leave us alone. It's like, hey, yeah, go ahead, talk, say what you want, eh, no big deal, okay. If you're right, if you're wrong, it's okay. But now it's like, oh no, if you don't agree, it's misinformation. It's not disinformation. That's the purposeful spreading of wrong information. That's what they're doing. It's misinformation. In other words, as opposed to just incorrect information. So it's a very different thing. Misinformation has like a purpose behind it. I guess what they're really saying is disinformation, but that's more of a psychological warfare kind of term. Anyway, so the problem is that we have this very strange censorship that's going on, and more and more people are starting to object and starting to realize. Well, I guess they're realizing it first, then they're objecting to it. But the fact that we have a gelding party that isn't screaming and yelling and saying "How dare you!" and hauling these people in—the Zuckerberg, Dorsey, and the guy from Google—I can't pronounce—in front of them, and just completely, like if they have our bill 230, section 230 rewrites, this problem would have been solved. Now I have a newer version of it, so it's easy to solve this stuff. It's just a matter of willpower, and they don't have it. All right. So why do I say that, the deaths are probably any, well, the person that said, I see estimates and articles up to 50,000, but the actual affidavit, the person who's swearing that this is true on penalty of perjury, says 45,000. Let me see if I find the right one. No, that's the lawsuit. Okay. There's a lawsuit here also we're going to go over. I've got I sent a copy to Jonathan, and we'll take a look at this. And this is it's from America's Frontline Doctors. And what it talks about is having an injunction against vaccinations under an emergency use. Okay. Because first of all, the emergency ended last July. Everything after that's been propaganda. And what they're doing is not. Hang on, I'm moving my computer to the front here a little bit. Sorry, I'm going to slide my microphone over. It gets complicated when you have a desk and you multitask through all this stuff. It's a very, very strange phenomenon the way things are going. And it's Dr. Peter McCullough, either he stole my line or I stole his, not knowing it. But we both come up with the same line, or unless we both thought of it independently, all roads lead to vaccines. Okay, and that's been the whole point all along. This entire pandemic was designed to lead you to vaccines and away from cures, away from treatments, away from anything else. In fact, they purposely avoid treatments so you'll end up in the hospital on a ventilator so that you scare the hell out of everybody else in the country. That's their marketing technique. This is how they're doing this. Okay, so anyway, a friend of mine sent me this. And I got the lawsuit sent to me, but this particular one I think I found myself here. And this is Declaration of Jane Doe, okay? Pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 1746, Jane Doe hereby declares. So obviously it's a whistleblower. So Jane can't name herself. She'll be immediately kicked out of the CDC, immediately prosecuted. Well, she'll lose her job. She'll be blacklisted. She'll have all the things done to her. She'll be doxxed. You know, she'll be vilified in the media. She'll be canceled. Her life will be ruined. She'll be destroyed. And all for her trying to present the correct information, okay, that she swears to here in an affidavit. Right. So, but this is the culture we live in. So she has to go under Jane Doe to protect herself. Hopefully the CDC has some kind of whistleblower protection. But as we know from the Veterans Administration, whistleblower protection, it's anything but. That's why I actually wrote with one of the Veterans Affairs employees a new whistleblower bill that actually protects whistleblowers. That's what we do here. I mean, that's what Action Radio is all about. So I'll get, maybe I should go through this. This is pretty cool. I am fully competent to make this declaration, and I have personal knowledge of the facts stated in the declaration. This declaration is submitted in support of legal actions to revoke the emergency use authorization for COVID-19 injections and in support of a preliminary injunction to immediately block the emergency use authorization for COVID-19 injections. Okay, so this is what I was saying before. In fact, I must have missed that the first time I read it. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, so this does tie in with a lawsuit. So an emergency use means that the situation is so bad that we have to do something right now that we don't know the full effects. But it's better than doing, you know, it's better than doing nothing, is what they're saying. So this is an emergency. We have to do this now. We have to make sure everybody has the vaccine now, you know, otherwise, you know, millions of people are going to die. And this is what they're saying, right? Of course, I don't believe any of that's true. A lot of other folks don't either, you know, because there are preventions and there are cures. And basically the preventions and the cures are the same thing. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamin D, vitamin C, you know the list. I mean, we've been going over this for over a year now. Okay. So if you have a prevention and you have a cure, then you don't have a pandemic. Okay. And it's just that simple. If you have we don't have a cure for the common cold, but we don't start doing things because the cold changes all the time, keeps mutating. Right? Well, same thing with this. It's kind of interesting that, yes, it's mutating. Yes, it's changing form. But as we talked about earlier from different doctors, the mutations are so close to the original, it doesn't matter. Except for the Delta variant, if you've been vaccinated, as this British study said, that people are six times more likely to die from the Delta variant if they have been vaccinated. I went over that the other day. I can do it again. You know, if anybody wants to, call me, 215-383-3832. Oh, I should probably mention this too. This is normally when Bill Fecke joins us, who has, you know, since the show began. But he's taking a break, and he'll be back next year, December, January. So he'll be back sometime when, you know, December 24th is our anniversary of the show. And day before Christmas, we started this in 2018. So coming up on, and we'll start our third year this December. Kind of interesting. Anyway, so he'll be back. But I'll be taking this half hour unless I find another report, which, of course, I'm always working on different reports. Anyway, so they're trying to stop the COVID injections under an emergency use. What they wanted, and these people are not saying that you should never have the vaccination or that you should never have a COVID vaccination. What they're saying is you should test it like you test all the other vaccinations, because this particular one, which I don't believe is a vaccination at all either. It's a messenger RNA genetic modification device. It's like GMOs modify food. Well, this vaccine modifies you. And do you want to get modified? I don't want to get modified. I don't get modified by Moderna's hacking of the software of life. I don't want to get modified by their injections. I kind of like my, what I call body integrity. Okay. So if you have not gotten the messenger RNA shot, you still have body integrity. Okay. In other words, you still got your original DNA that hasn't been messed with. The original code that God gave you still exists. All right. And once you get the shot, the original code that God gave you does not exist because it's modified. Okay. And I, quite frankly, I don't want to go there because, you know, I have more faith in God than I have in, Dr. Fauci. It's really that simple. It's an easy choice. You know, in fact, if you gave people a choice, you know, do you want your body the way it is or do you trust Dr. Fauci to modify it? I thought it was a preventive. I thought I would, I would never get, COVID. Well, they don't say that. They say they'll listen. You know, the actual medical literature says that the vaccines will lessen the symptoms if you get COVID. Well, what kind of guarantee is that? Anyway, so the point of all this is I'm going round and round and round, is that there's no need for an emergency use authorization when there's no emergency. As much as these folks want to convince you there is, they change the numbers, they change the indexes, they change the death count, they went to cases, they use a test that's inaccurate, you know, the media inflates it, they change the numbers anyway, they report people as dying, you know, with COVID, as dying from COVID, you know, and we all know that the CDC said only 6% of the folks that died with COVID actually died from it, 6%. So I think we figured that out to be about 36,000 people. All right. So the 600,000 people that have died with COVID, about 36,000 actually died from it. Now, it's ironic that the count came out for overdoses for 2020, and the overdoses of opioids are over 90,000. So if you want to put that in perspective, you know, COVID is like one third as dangerous as the opioid overdoses. You're almost three times more likely to die from an opioid overdose as you are from COVID. Think about that, because that's what they're saying right now. You know, 90,000 some odd opioid deaths and about 36,000 deaths actually from COVID. Okay. Wow. Back to the affidavit. She says, I'm a computer programmer with subject matter expertise in the healthcare data analytics field, an honor that allows me access to Medicare and Medicaid data maintained by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's the CMS. Never heard of them. All right. She says, I earned a BS degree in mathematics and have, over the last 25 years, developed over 100 distinct healthcare fraud detection algorithms, both in the public and private sector. This is one smart person. Okay. First of all, if you've got a degree in mathematics, it's interesting that a healthcare person has a degree in mathematics. Okay, so how would that help you? Well, if you know mathematics, if you've got 25 years experience and a degree in mathematics, you probably know a lot about statistics. Okay, both how they're manipulated and how they're properly used. That's why I think this is such a key that the person has expertise in mathematics, because this is really about the numbers, the CDC numbers that are not even close to accurate. All right. She says, it has been my mission to protect federal tax dollars. That's our money, folks, by preventing and detecting healthcare fraud, a process which leads to both recovery of overpayments and law enforcement leads. A large part of what I do is focused on the quality of care for the beneficiary. For example, I identify providers who prescribe an egregious amount of opioids to patients with a history of overdosing. Well, isn't that interesting? In fact, we were just talking about that. She says, instead of titrating the patient off of opioids, they prescribe more, oftentimes leading to patient death. In other words, doctors are killing people to make money because they know they're addicted and they know they're going to keep buying it until they're dead. Now, titrating is a process. Oh, let's go back to college chemistry or titrating. It's a process. It's like distillation. In other words, they take very small amounts of something from something else. In other words, you're separating a very small amount of a particular thing. I think we did with nicotine in a big sample of stuff, of like whatever it was, and we were able to extract the nicotine from the sample. All right, same thing here. So they're supposed to, you know, in other words, titrating off opioids means to wean you off, you know, a little bit at a time, as opposed to giving you enough to kill you. She says, when the COVID-19 vaccine clearly became associated with patient death and harm, I was naturally inclined to investigate the matter. This is one curious person too. So here's where it goes. This is the meat and potatoes right here. She says, it is my professional estimate that VAERS, that's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System database, while extremely useful, is underreported by a conservative factor of at least 5. You hear that? A conservative factor. So it's 5 times underreported. The actual total is 5 times greater than what they're reporting. She says, on July 9th, 2021, slow down, Greg, July 9th, 2021, there were 9,048 deaths reported in VAERS. I verified these numbers by collating all of the data from VAERS myself, not relying on a third party to report them. Yeah, she does her own research. This is another reason I trust this person. She says, in tandem, I queried data from CMS medical claims with regard to vaccines and patient deaths, and have assessed that the deaths occurring within 3 days of vaccination are higher than those reported to VAERS by a factor of at least 5. This would indicate that the true number of vaccine-related deaths was at least 45,000. Put in perspective, the swine flu vaccine was taken off the market, which only resulted in 53 deaths. Okay? That's kind of staggering. They took swine flu off the market for 53 deaths, and this thing has at least 45,000, according to our mathematician here. Well, think about that. So VAERS is a voluntary reporting system, all right? And a lot of people, or Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. I've got another article saying it's kind of tough to report. People are underreporting. The doctors aren't saying that people died of the vaccine. They're saying they died of who knows what. Okay. So a lot of people don't know. However, the medical claims, that's something different. So if people want money, if people want money, yeah, now they're reporting more accurately. So I find that, so let me go back over that section. So I find it fascinating. She says, I've tried these numbers by collating all the facts from the VAERS, that's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And then she says, in tandem, I queried data from the CMS medical claims. So the medical claims with regard to vaccines and patient deaths. So in other words, the doctors want to get paid. Okay. So the people reporting the deaths for money are a lot more accurate than the people reporting deaths when the doctors tell them to or not to. So you've got a case here where I'm sure the doctors are saying to the patients, just so they don't want to have the liability, nope, they didn't die from the vaccine. Yet they're reporting yet they did die to the vaccine when it comes to medical claims. That's fascinating. All right. That in itself deserves a congressional investigation. I should send this along to Gates. Haven't heard from him lately. I wonder why. Oh, well, fame. All right. So put in perspective this one. All right, there we go. So she says, I declare under penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America that the foregoing is true and correct. Okay? So there you go. So perjury carries a multi-year prison term. If you commit perjury, if you swear that this is the best information, that you've done the research, that you've looked at the numbers, you've got multiple sources, and you say that the VAERS, you know, 9,000+ deaths are off by a factor of 5, and it's more like 45,000, that's pretty heavy-duty stuff. And she's saying this, and the reason I trust this is because it is. It's like the people that come forward in the election correction. So wait a minute, I saw them take the boxes out. I saw them count the same vote 15 times. I saw the envelopes come in. I saw the ballots come in, you know, that was supposedly mailed in that were never folded. Yeah, I saw that, okay? And they put it down on paper, and they're legally responsible for that, right? It's amazing that the people legally responsible for the affidavits are a lot more legally responsible than the people that actually committed the election fraud so far. This is where it gets very interesting. All right, so I'm going to keep this one and see if Jonathan wants to go into it more. But I find this fascinating. So this is what's going on. So we've got censorship. We got a situation where the only way I can bring this information is the show, which means the only way you can bring what I just told you to other people is to read the information, look for the affidavit. It's not hard to find. You know, it's if I could post it. If I post it on my own page. So it doesn't look like much. It looks like a tiny little blip of a thing, but it's there. It's most definitely there. Okay, so let me see. That's that. Let's put this over here. Yeah, there's another thing, too. I have another question for both Jonathan and Claire. Mike Lee has a bill to overturn the War Powers Act and have a new set of powers act. And I was reminded of an article I wrote. I'll probably take this up with Dr. Peter Prime Monday. And the article was on, why the president is not commander-in-chief unless there's a declared war. I find that quite interesting. All right, I'm going to take a break for a minute here and let you listen to Santa Rosa Volunteers, the Anti-Federalist number 2, because once Jonathan gets going and Claire gets going, I really don't like to interrupt them. So I think this break the Bill's taking now is actually going to work out quite well. I might bring him back another day and just keep this Thursday because our two, you know, there are three powerhouses, really, Bill, Jonathan, and Claire. It's nice to not interrupt them and give you a chance to listen to our Santa Rosa Volunteers, Anti-Federalist number 2. And again, this is helping me as much as anybody, because as I expand my knowledge on what the Federalists, you know, I'm pretty familiar with what the Federalists said. I'm not at all familiar with what the Anti-Federalists said. So listen to this. I'll have more information for you. And back in a few minutes. Now let's get the start here. Here it goes. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments. Insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers, here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. It's funny how all the writing from our founding, all the authors, think that multiple paragraphs of preamble is somehow preferable to getting to the main points. Anti-Federalist number 2. Like every other paper I've read so far, has several paragraphs of introduction, but the main points, the really important stuff, is at the bottom. If you don't have time, if you don't have the time of a quill pen and horse society with no internet, I advise starting these Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers about halfway through. Anti-Federalist number 2 was written by William Grayson, June 11, 1788. He, like all the Anti-Federalists, question the need for a constitution at all, when all the convention was really asked to do was update the Articles of Confederation. Why an arrogant group of elitists gathered in Philadelphia at this constitutional convention to totally change everything from a confederation of independent states, more like independent nations, to a union of United States, especially since, except for a few exceptions, the people, as in we the people, the folks government is supposed to serve, were for the most part happy with their independent states. Let's get into his bombshells in the last few paragraphs of his anti-federalist paper. Grayson says this: there are certain modes of governing the people which will succeed. There are others which will not. The idea of consolidation is abhorrent to the people of this country. How were the sentiments of the people before the meeting of the Convention of Philadelphia? They had only one object in view. Their ideas reached no farther than to give the general government the 5 per centum impost and the regulation of trade. When it was agitated in Congress, in the Committee of the Whole, this was all that was asked, or was deemed necessary. Since that period, their views have extended much farther. Horrors have been greatly magnified since the rising of the convention. William Grayson has a theme in his paper about how the people want to be governed, and not how the elites think the people want to be governed. He highlights that in the people sent their representatives to the convention in Philadelphia to regulate trade among the states and run the government by taxing imports at 5% through an impost, so that the importing companies paid for the U.S. government and the people didn't. My source on impost is the Duke University Library Answer Person. The real brilliance of William Grayson, something I believe is lost to history for those who do not read the Anti-Federalist Papers, is his analysis of the big picture of government. He has already stated that the people wanted basically two issues solved, not an entire form of government created. He also has an alternative to the Constitution with which he concludes his analysis. The two choices of the convention in Philadelphia were to amend the Articles of Confederation so that they created a system that worked, which is what the Anti-Federalists wanted, or to ratify the Constitution, which did come out of that convention, which is what the Federalists wanted. In opposition to that outcome, Grayson says next, "But what would I do on the present occasion to remedy the existing defects of the present Confederation? There are two opinions prevailing in the world. The one, that mankind can only be governed by force. The other, that they are capable of freedom and a good government. Under a supposition that mankind can govern themselves, I would recommend that the present Confederation should be amended. Give Congress the regulation of commerce, infuse new strength and spirit into the state governments, for when the component parts are strong, it will give energy to the government, although it be otherwise weak." This is almost Orwellian, but in a good sense, what William Grayson is saying, and I agree, that in government, weakness is strength. It sounds like a contradiction, but it's really a guarantee, because neither the people nor the individual can be ruled by force by a government that is too weak. So our guarantee in the strength of the people and the people to exercise their individual rights is in the gradual weakening of government power and replacing that with the gradual increase in the power of the people. Because ultimately, what Grayson is saying is that only through a purposefully and responsibly weak government will the people be capable of exercising freedom and to receive a good government. I may have to think, or rethink actually, our entire strategy here at Action Radio based on this. I have plans to disarm the bureaucracies and abolish the FBI, but I may have to reevaluate the idea of a responsibly weak government so that the people are not only capable of freedom, but actively participating in it, because the only good government is a responsibly weak one, not one that can rule by force. Guess what we have today? William Grayson ends with his practical solutions now that he has outlined his overall principles. He says, "Apportion the public debts in such a manner as to throw the unpopular ones on the back lands. Call only for requisitions for the foreign interest and aid them by loans. Keep on So till the American character be marked with some certain features, we are yet too young to know what we are fit for. The continual migration of people from Europe and the sentiment of new countries on our western frontiers are strong arguments against making new experiments now in government. When these things are removed, we can, with greater prospect of success, devise changes. We ought to consider, as Montesquieu says, whether the construction of the government be suitable to the genius and disposition of the people, as well as a variety of other circumstances. In other words, pay the debts with the sale of land so the debts don't become overwhelming in time. Avoid any foreign aid that isn't a loan. Wait until the unique American character emerges from the colonies before imposing an entirely new form of government through a constitution. Hold off on creating a new government system until immigration from Europe and Asia has stabilized and enough people are here. And only after all this, and our true American character has emerged, should we create a government system equal to the people and their freedom, and not force the people to live under the imposed government that goes way beyond what the people ever intended. Oh, if we only could have seen how that would have worked out. A source for this report is federalistpapers.org. The anti-federalist paper source is selfeducatedamerican.com. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Hey, we should have Jonathan joining us in just a minute here. Let me give you a little Biden PSA on why you don't want to take the vaccine. I'll play this for you, and I'll be right back. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. You've all heard those ads for people who have suffered medical or health tragedies, which say you may be entitled to compensation. But if you have suffered injuries or crippling diseases or medical procedures that went horribly wrong, it's not the compensation you need, it's the knowledge you should have had before the condition you suffer from now. So that you are never in that position in the future, I strongly recommend that you do not get any COVID vaccines. Get informed. Do your own research. For 99.97% of Americans, your natural immunity will give you, at worst, only moderate symptoms of COVID. If you've already had COVID, it's virtually impossible to get it again. There are effective cures for COVID, which will get you completely over the virus. There is no cure for the COVID-19 vaccines. Once you start down the road of DNA modification, there is no going back. Yeah. Every time I hear that, it gets me, and I'm the one that made it, so it's really quite interesting. All right, so there's so much going on with the Arizona audit and the hopefully New Georgia audits and Pennsylvania and everything that's happening. The news, the printed news, is kind of, you know, waiting to catch up. But here's what I've been listening to from One American News and some of the other places, National File, and some of the different sources I've been going to. It looks like the audit in Arizona is going to prove what we all knew, that Trump won, that the Maricopa County Phoenix operation was so bad that and so tainted, and everything from, you know, ballot stuffing, mail ballot stuffing, you know, computerized voter machine fraud, you name it, it didn't really matter. You know, recounting, you know, the same ballots twice. I mean, just all the different things that are going on, it's like they're all happening in Maricopa County. And so what the question is, the big question is how do they actually recall it? Because this has never been done before. And you know, of course, the Democrats are going to say, well, wait a minute, you know, Biden got sworn in. He's the president. Well, Nixon got sworn in too, and he was the president. He had to resign, you know, 8 months later. And so people forget that just because you're sworn in doesn't mean you get to stay. That's what impeachment's all about. But you can't impeach Biden because he's not president. So what you have to do is recall the electors, you know, and correct the election, say that, whoop, we goofed. We screwed up the first time, and now we're going to correct this. We're going to take out the fraud ballots and disqualify the county. That, see, you don't have to prove every fraud ballot. You don't have to say, you know, which one was frauds and how many, because you'll never know, you know. So you can't prove the impossible, but you don't have to prove the impossible. All you have to do is show there was enough fraud to discount, you know, a county's votes. And if you take out Maricopa County, Trump wins in a landslide. He won anyway, but it's just much more dramatic that way. And so what happens is when you discount that and Trump wins a state that was previously thought that Trump lost, he gets the electors. Now, this is the part that we've never done before, and this is why this is interesting. And so as we sort of wade through this, let me give you the latest source I found. This is National File. Arizona audit finds enough tainted ballots to erase Biden's lead as senators call to decertify the election. Okay, so this is the part that I think Karen Fan, the Senate president, said you can't do, and the other senator said, well, yeah, you can. So really what's happening here is people, you know, the Democrats say, well, you can't audit this. And the Republican state legislators, well, yes, we can. You know, and as Jonathan pointed out to me, you know, Dan Bongino said, when the courts or anybody says that you can't audit, or the North Carolina, I think, Secretary of State said you can't audit, you know, Bongino says, well, we're not asking to audit. We're telling you we're auditing, okay? Anyway, so this article says President Donald Trump supporters and American patriots nationwide are emboldened after an Arizona State Senate hearing on the Maricopa County election audit proved massive fraud. Proved massive fraud. Should I do that one more time? Audit proved massive fraud. Among the audit's findings so far, 11,326 people in the county who voted in the November 3rd election were not on the voter rolls on November 7th. Well, isn't that interesting? But we're at the voter rolls by December 4th. So not only did they add votes, they added voters. So they added voters to cover for the vote they added. This is fascinating. These people are so guilty. It's crazy. This number is higher than Joe Biden's supposed statewide lead in Arizona of 10,157 votes. You know, it's fascinating to me that anybody would believe, even Democrats, would believe that Joe Biden could beat Donald Trump in an honest election. That in itself is laughable. Okay, especially given what he's done so far. No one would believe it today, you know, based on the gas prices, the pipeline we've lost, the horrible foreign policy, the inflation rate. You know, well, I'd say the gas prices, inflation rate alone is what affects most people, and the shortages and the food prices and everything else. So like, what the hell is this? We didn't have this under Trump, you know, and that's how most people are going to find with, you know, this is what's happening. Anyway, but it's fascinating. It says additionally, this is back to the article, right? More than 74,000 mail-in ballots were counted in the county, even though there is no recorded evidence of the ballots being sent to the voters in the first place. That's a neat trick, okay? How do you explain to me how you do that? Explain to me how you count 74,000 votes that weren't mail-in ballots that weren't mailed out. Okay, this is why this is such a fraud. But what I find interesting is that the fraudsters, the Democrat fraudsters that rigged the election, they only rigged it to have a very small margin of victory. All right. You know, if they were so confident in their candidate, why didn't they have like, you know, 8, 9, 10, well, have a million votes in Arizona over for Biden? Okay. Or did that look too obviously fraudulent? All right. So they had just enough, you know, over their over Trump to make it look like Biden just squeaked by. Just enough votes, right? So that he could, you know, skip over the line. But when you have a very few vote margin of victory, you also have a very few vote margin of loss. And that's, of course, what they're going through right now. So anyway, there's a bunch of stuff going on here. I'm just going to bring on Jonathan because it's more fun to talk to him than sort of, you know, rattle all this stuff off. And I've covered it pretty well. I think I've covered what I wanted to cover, you know, in terms of the whistleblower, the CDC whistleblower, which I'll talk to Jonathan about too if he wants, and all these other fascinating things that are going on. But let me play his theme just because I love it and really kind of sets the mood. It's the longest of our themes, but I think it's also the best of our themes, and it'll put you in the mood to really seriously buckle down and talk about the law. It probably started with an episode of Perry Mason many years ago. That yearning to understand the law so that you can help people who don't understand the law. The arguments, the debates, the mental trial beyond the actual trial, all the while trying to do the best you can for your client. He walks the halls of justice, pictures on the wall of great minds who advance the law. He walks not in the black robes of the judge, but the suit and tie of the attorney. Known as counselor, lawyer, or any number of other names, and after years of hard work, these are the people accepted to the bar and allowed to practice law, especially at trial. For it is at trial, many times, that the great decisions of our society are realized. It's where the laws get tested. It's where juries have lost their power to judge the laws and not just the facts. It's where judges make up their own law, especially through interpretations. But if you are ever in trouble, your attorney can be your best friend. We are privileged at Action Radio to have one of those practitioners of the law, someone who knows the Constitution, who knows about due process, who takes the rights of the individual as sacred and will fight for them with all he's got. It is at this time every week that we immerse ourselves in the law. So join us in the law as we go to the Action Radio Legal Report with Jonathan Mosley. What an exciting time to be a lawyer, huh? You must be having some great adventures out there. Good morning, Jonathan. Oh, where's your phone line? Bad phone connection. Nope, still can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Now I can. Yeah, we need to get you a microphone. We got to get you, with the microphone and headset, something. I can send the Direct Connects. Yeah, then you sound like me, Jonathan Mosley with the lawyer voice. So where are you? I know you're there, Jonathan.
Yeah. I can hear you fine.
Oh yeah. Okay. You're in and out. All I heard was I can hear you fine. So let's start again here.
I don't know. It's like I say, I'm 20 miles from Washington, D.C., and there's no...
Oh, this is going to drive me crazy.
Cell phone blocker operating.
Yeah. No, you're fading in and out. I don't know if you have wherever that favorite spot is that you stand where you can...
Well, that's outside, and then I can't look at anything on my computer while I'm talking because I'm at my front stoop to be able to get a signal.
Well, I'd rather actually have you outside. If you need a resource, I can go over it and I can pull it up on my computer because I'm sitting right in front of one. So let's try that. Let's get you the best reception. And we can just talk. You know, I find that it's better when we're doing a dialogue to not necessarily refer to the sources because I've got so much stuff in my brain right now that I could probably help out with anything that way. I'd rather just have the conversation. And anything you need to look up, let me know and I can go right to the source. I've got the lawsuits. I've got the Jane Doe affidavit on COVID. If you want to start there with the emergency use authorization, there's the America's Frontline Doctors lawsuit. Okay, good. Now I can hear you.
Yeah, you were talking about that. I was going to say that it is a lot going on. It is exciting, except that it's also going against the grain of society. It's kind of like, who was it with the hemlock when they
Socrates.
What?
Socrates.
Yeah, Socrates. They didn't want to hear what he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people don't want to hear the truth, unfortunately. But in any event, so this is what's, being a lawyer is interesting, but it's like people really don't want to know what's going on. Not judges.
Well, and it's interesting because you deal with the professional folks. I mean, the judges want to keep their jobs, as you've said. The lawyers are weenies. The Republican lawyers are geldings just like the rest of the party. But if you look at what's going on in America right now, Arizona, the state, I've never seen the state so active in anything ever. You've got Arizona. They're now talking about decertifying the election, okay? So they've gone from the audit to they got the information. They haven't released all the information yet. But, and of course, then one of the people said, well, you can't decertify. Biden's in office now, which I reminded folks that, Nixon was in office too. This stopped him, from being forced out and having to resign. In many respects, Nixon more honorable than Biden in that respect. I don't think Nixon would ever actually blatantly steal an election like that, but it's just interesting the moral decay and turpitude that we have descended into. But the states are – people are listening, and all the fake news sites are – One American News had is the fake news sites are fading, even Fox News, right? And Newsmax, One American News, and sources – I do a lot with National File, a lot of other different sources, Gateway Pundit, things like that, these fabulous sources of information, and people are reading them. And people are noticing, and more people believe the election's a fraud than it was honest. It's like 61% right now. That's pretty good. So if you poll judges and the folks that you deal with in the world lawyer world, right, you're going to find a very different result than if you go out to St. Louis or Denver, any of this regular American cities, the heartland, even the West Coast, East Coast, 61% of people in this country. Every group that they surveyed, there's a greater majority that believe it was a fraud than it was honest. That's pretty good. So we're in good shape as far as that goes.
And the thing is, it's critically important whether people stay involved. I mean, typically, you know, as we said, it, everything really does come down to the citizens. They can't, none of this can, if people don't stand up and assert themselves. So the, really, it all comes down to whether people are going to go back to sleep again.
I don't think so.
That's going to decide the future of where we go.
Okay.
Because, like I say, I've been, what?
No, I just said okay. No, I
can
I can hear you. You're fine.
All
Keep going. Yeah, you're good.
So the thing is it's about, you know, it's about, because we've seen this these things happen before. I mean, back in the 70s and the 80s when my mother was involved in the Eagle Forum and all these things happen, there'll be this spasm of interest, and then people will go back to sleep, and that's how we lose our country. And that's part of, I think, why people are so outrageously arrogant and everything, because they fit, you know, they've seen it before, and they figure that, well, this will just die out. People will go back to the way it was, and we'll just wait them out until the American people lose this. So really, you know, and everybody wonders, you know, what can I do? You know, how do we save our country and everything like this? And the answer often is, you know, you cannot quit. The famously, the conservative movement, the Patriots, whatever you want to call it, we get involved. We'll man the ramparts. We'll protest. We'll do all this stuff until we start to see a little bit of daylight, and then we quit and go home.
Yeah.
And not only is that how we lose our country, but everybody that you think, like, how could they be so arrogant? Because they're expecting that. They've seen it before. So the biggest thing that everybody can do is don't give up. Don't go back to sleep. You have to be in this. You can't be a summer soldier. You can't be a summer patriot. You have to be in it for Valley Forge. And that's going to decide the thing back and forth. But so, you know, there's this inevitable ratchet that the leftists never give up, and we do. So
I was just going to say, it reminds me of the Tea Party, which I used to take part in San Francisco when I was there. And I would be at the rallies and I would make speeches. And I thought, this is great. We're actually going to do something. Taxed enough already. Tea. You know, and then they just kind of faded out. So, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. Now they're trying to resurrect themselves. But, you know, once you fade, you know, you can't suddenly leap back in, because people are going to have the expectation that you're going to fade out again. So it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy,
right,
like you're talking about. Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
It's a little bit more complicated than that, because you know, there was a lot of discussion about whether the Tea Party should work within the Republican Party, whether it should be a separate party, how it should operate. And I think there was this consensus that we had a better chance of being a component of the Republican Party. And they learn how to do things within the system instead of just standing on a street corner. And that's where it, you know, because I know people in the Tea Party dealing with it. So that's how it changed. But many of them, you know, that was, yeah, because I don't think it went away. I think they became part of an enlarged Republican Party. They need to learn things. By the way, what's the call-in number here again? I'm trying to get...
Oh, yeah, you can always call in, but if you have to call in, 215-383-3832. It's right on the website. So if you're ever, you know, pull up the show on Blog Talk, it's right there. So anybody can find it. 215. Yeah,
John said it wouldn't come in. But anyway, so here's the thing is that, you know, we talk about how, you know, the judges are afraid too much about what people are going to think. And they're not afraid of us for all the reasons we're talking about. And they need to be. So anyway, so here we have all of these things happening like this. And you're talking about, you know, with Arizona stuff. It's interesting because I've heard, you know, my initial reaction is that in the law there's the feeling that there's the expectation with courts that if courts make a wrong decision, and it's still a decision. And so, you know, it's treated in the law that they made the wrong decision, but that's the decision. However, I heard some very interesting legal analysis recently.
Yeah.
What?
I said, that's dumb.
Under
that doesn't
make
any sense.
But the 10th Amendment saying that it isn't, you know, on the one hand, we say there's nothing in the Constitution that says that you can correct a mistake in the election by removing the sitting president. But I've heard some very interesting legal analysis that, well, there's nothing saying you can't either.
Yeah.
And then you add to that the 10th Amendment, which explicitly says that any power, you know, not explicitly delegated to the United States government is reserved to the states.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that starts to tip the table in the favor of, if the states do it, who are you to tell them they can't? Because it explicitly says that they have all the powers that are not explicitly delegated to the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of adds to the idea that if a state wants to cancel its certification to the electors, now there are deadlines established in there and whatever, but then again, what the argument is that fraud and those things may erase deadlines, because, you know, although there are deadlines and something like that, it assumes that it's not a fraudulent act. So it's interesting. It could be anything. So we'll see. I think Arizona, you know, Georgia suddenly decided to. I mean, because you see the Georgia leadership strike. Mm-hmm. I don't know them personally, but they strike me as the people who get up in the morning, put their finger in their, you know, wet their finger and put it in the wind, and they are overwhelmingly, and the kind of people who are like that. If you try to explain to them that there's another way to think, they'd think you're a talking dog. They'd have no way of knowing. I'm like, what the heck are you talking about? By the way, if you see an 804 number calling in, that would be John Quapitz.
Oh, he's here. He just popped up. Let's bring him on.
Yeah,
you want to finish your point first?
So the point is that, you know, now after what's happening in Arizona, Georgia is, you know, suddenly acting like, you know, they were in on the, you know, audit movement all along, you know, because they have no principle. They have no concept of right or wrong. They have no morality, and they wouldn't understand it if you tried to explain it to them.
They
think it was a foreign. It's just like whatever is, you know, their entire being is whatever makes them, you know, it has advantage for them at the moment. And they cannot even conceive of another way of looking at the world. So suddenly Georgia is like, oh, yeah, we're all in on the, you know, just because they're seeing the momentum shift.
Yeah.
And I think that momentum is going to shift in different places. But again, why is all this happening in Arizona and starting in Pennsylvania, although it's an uphill battle? I mean, we have state, where was it? Was it, I think it was Pennsylvania where the Secretary of State says, you know, ordered election officials to not cooperate with an audit.
Yeah, just hit North Carolina. Just
oh, that happened too. Yes.
Yeah.
North Carolina. It's like, who the hell do they think they are?
well, no, they're making
again,
these
the
proclamations,
and
then the state legislature is like, no, you can't do that. So the pushback, as they say, is incredible. And that's the part that's interesting. People used to take it. They used to take those orders. They used to take those declarations. They used to take all those things of power and say, when they said you can't do it. And now people are saying, yeah, we can. We can recall the electors. We can, you know, change the electoral college vote. Yeah.
But the biggest reason for all that is that the people are demanding it. And it's like,
yes.
I've seen this before where there'll be some outrage and every like I think when China was going to control the Panama Canal or something, even Hillary Clinton was out there calling for legislation, and then 6 months later everybody forgot about it and they just let it go back to business as usual. So, you know, right now there's so much pressure that they're going to go along with all this, and we can't stop the pressure. It has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, people have to think – people have to think, you know, I what can I do? I can't – you know, I can vote, but I'm just one vote. I can't do anything. Believe me, the uproar is driving everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything good that is happening is because the people are in an uproar, and you gotta keep yelling.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I got your guests live right now. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you finish, I'll get them introduce them too. Yeah, or you can introduce them.
Yeah, I'll introduce. So I wanted to, you know, like I say, I. unfortunately, I've got very difficult challenges right now. In fact, what I was trying to stay up all night, but I didn't.
Oh, don't do that.
To write the
That's college.
Grand
that hurts.
Jury indictment. Yeah, citizen's grand jury indictment against Fauci. And, of course, it's always harder than it sounds. So I've still got probably a couple more hours, and Larry wanted it at 8 this morning. But I did want to, even aside from that, I wanted to introduce John Kwapitz, who taught me probably half of what I know about politics. And I'll leave it at that because he can decide on the good half and decide which half it is.
Well, thank you for bringing him on.
John Kwapitz goes back to Madison, Wisconsin, which like may as well, have been Moscow back when it was communist. And, he knows everything about all these things. He ran the Center for Peace and Freedom, a project of the Heritage Foundation covertly, not on our part, but on theirs. And it was named that way so that the news media would open the envelopes. I mean, we were as conservative as it came, but we knew back in the 80s that the media was, not on our side, as Chris Plant says. And so he knows everything. And I'm concerned that, again, when people talk about CRT being communist or the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being communist and they're pushing these things, people don't know what that means.
Yeah.
they think that communists are only in Russia. And they think that, they only understand communism in terms of somebody's going to try to, send a spy or a missile at us. They have no concept of what it means to live in a communist society. Therefore, when communism is happening here, they don't recognize it. We don't know what it is because we don't know anything
lie
about
to them.
It.
So let's get your guest on here. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right. So John Kwapitz, I'm hoping over time can help educate us in a lot of these things. So, John, can you hear us?
Welcome to the show, sir.
Hello there. How are you?
We're having a great time. We're glad you're here. Welcome to Action Radio.
Okay. Well, thank you. I must say thank you to John for that introduction. One thing I would definitely quibble about, and that is when he said he knows everything. I certainly do not know everything.
Hey, listen, this show's an experiment.
I did provide some insights to John over time, but he certainly has learned a lot about politics on his own and is quite astute. I was enjoying his discussion, his presentation earlier on the election issue. I think it's extremely important that we continue to push to look into what has happened back in November. Down to the point of actually trying to indict people who had committed election law violations at the local level. Ultimately, I don't think there's going to be any possibility of changing the election to reinstate
Why?
Trump. But
why do you think that?
Just because of the constitutional situation. But I don't want to go into that. But it's really important that we pursue this because we need to get the public to understand the fraud that occurred and how duplicitous the Democrats are. I mean, frankly, to me, they're a criminal conspiracy, as Dinesh D'Souza has said, and they're kind of a political mafia, and the public is not aware of this. But the more we can bring to light this fraud that occurred, the theft of votes that occurred, the more people will realize what kind of an organization, what kind of people, at least at the national level and to some degree at the local level, lower, going down to Democrat operatives. But that's another issue, so to speak.
Okay. It just seems all right, go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
Well, I know you don't want to go too deeply into this, but it seems a contradiction to me that if you can arrest people for election fraud, you can't change the results of that fraud. There's something that immediately leaps out at me. It's like, wait a minute, why can you do one without the other? Why can you arrest somebody for embezzlement and not fix the books? For example, that's what it sounds like. Does that make sense?
Well, no, I mean, logically, objectively, that makes sense, what you're saying, definitely. That seems reasonable. But I think the way the system is set up at this point, the thing is done, and it's just unrealistic to think. And the pathway to getting to trying to change it at this point is just not really there legally,
okay.
I don't think. People can argue about that, but I think it just isn't going to work. But that doesn't mean we should give up and be discouraged about it. As I say, it's really important that we continue to push to get the truth out, to find the truth and get it out.
Interesting.
For the future.
Jonathan? Yeah, Jonathan, you brought John on. Do you have more questions? Because I have a ton right now. Yeah.
At best, it's unknown.
Okay.
And what we do know, as I think John is referring to partly, is that we know the political establishment is not eager to do something, you know, that would be right. I think so. And there was a Supreme Court justice, John has a law degree too, who said sometimes the law is an ass. I think like 150 years ago.
Was that
Hugo Black or something? You know, he said, you know, sometimes when you look at it, you say, well, this doesn't sound right. And he's like, well, yeah, but, you know, sometimes the law is just an ass, is what, and he said, this isn't a Supreme Court opinion. So,
you're fading out a bit there.
Change doesn't happen unless you push it to the limit. But,
right.
Okay.
Also, speaking of the law as an ass, I think Lord Johnson in England about 300 years ago said the same thing, which can be true in a number of occasions.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I love these pronouncements. Like, you'll have these grandiose sayings. And one of my other favorite ones when we were talking, I forgot exactly how it came up, but we were doing I related the obscenity laws as covering the things that Section 230 covers. And I don't know if you want to get into that, but it's like the definition of pornography. You know, I think the judges, I think Berger said, well, I know it when I see it. That really defines it. That narrows it down. You know, we've got Pianca in the line too, so I'll get to him in just a second. But this is interesting. So, you know, I'm looking at this election situation, and to me, put me in the unrealistic camp. I have said from the beginning that this has to be fixed, it has to be corrected. And once Trump, these elections are decertified, and Trump gets over 270 electoral votes, then something's going to have to give somewhere. But my question for you, John, is, anytime, if the federal government were actually investigating this, if Bill Barr had done his job and they took a look at these states and said, well, let's see if we can find some anomalies, as they say, that would be classified as an ongoing investigation. Okay. So why aren't these audits also classified as ongoing investigations? And why wouldn't that suspend any operation or any executive orders or any action at all out of, you know, what I call the Biden regime, simply because they've got an ongoing investigation? What do you think?
Well, personally, I would say that the ongoing investigation is not exactly ongoing. It began well after the election was over. Unfortunately, they did not allow on the investigations in November, December. The courts threw the efforts out so that there was not an ongoing investigation in any given state that might have held up their certification. So I don't think it applies in this case at this point. It's kind of after the fact. Now we're in a quandary, but as I said, I think
how do you see us getting out of it?
Imperative that we continue to push and find out the truth. Okay. And there are many people that deserve to be indicted and sent to jail at the local level. And I really hope that the problem also though is that many areas. The Commonwealth's attorney, the district attorneys in most of these cities are Democrats. And so they're not going to investigate anything, and they're not going to indict anybody. It's a sad thing. But in other areas where there are some Republican-type or at least honest district attorneys, and maybe in some cases a state attorney general might initiate an effort to go after some of these people based on all the evidence and affidavits we have of violations of election law locally.
Okay, so let's say that we get some of the lower folks, you know, indicted. To me, you mentioned the Democrats being like a racketeering operation, and I would say that the RICO statutes apply. And what if the indictments go all the way up to the person sitting in the White House? And the vice person sitting in the White House. I mean, if the indictments start at the low level, could they not be followed up the chain to get everybody who are accessories who participated in some way, who knew about it and didn't say so? I mean, how far can this go if you start indictments at the lower level Why can't that be extended all the way up the chain of complicity?
Well, I think it could if you have people who will open up. I mean, you're going to have a whistleblower. You're going to have an informant. Somebody's going to have to finally break the silence.
All right.
But that's dangerous. I mean, this is literally like the mafia of people who might try to do that really do risk their lives because, okay. You know, the whole ball game, the whole thing was at stake here in 2020. And this is the people behind this obviously are not just in the U.S. This was an international effort
right.
here to get rid of Trump because he stood in the way of the global reset and everything else. But nonetheless,
yeah,
if
exactly.
you get the
yeah.
information, if you can begin mm-hmm. to, if you can indict some people, if you can get some people to turn state's evidence and talk mm-hmm. about, you know, the evidence reveal about the higher ups, then with a not, you know, with a good attorney general, district attorney, that could be pursued, and it could go, you know, depending on what they could find and whether people will talk. People are not going to talk. That's the problem.
Well, there's affidavits.
Like
50,000 affidavits. But what
Sorry.
About all the, you know, well, the like the Jenna Ellis, Rudy Giuliani hearings when they ran around before the audit started, they collected thousands upon thousands of affidavits of people that documented the fraud. Wouldn't those be the
yeah.
whistleblowers? Wouldn't those be the people? Couldn't you use those if you had a decent judge in a decent court? Wouldn't those be the first things brought up and those people be called as witnesses? I would think.
Yes, definitely that would be the case. If
okay.
But to do that, unfortunately, you've got to have a district attorney who is willing to initiate an investigation and to get a grand jury going. Mm.
And
90% of the situations they're not. But those
yeah,
people again
yeah, okay.
Those people were not really whistleblowers. They were mostly normal citizens, Republican mm-hmm. activists who saw something happening at their local precinct.
Okay.
They're good people. But they're not the whistleblowers from the inside, very by and large. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that I don't, you know, I may get in trouble for saying this, but I don't know.
Oh, don't cut out
what,
now. It's just getting
he,
good.
What,
he cut
did
out.
He say?
He's got a phone that cuts out, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Jonathan, we got to get you a microphone. This is nuts. But try to get
it. Let me mention one
you know,
other
like
thing.
20 minutes. Go ahead.
John?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It, to me, was really interesting. If you remember back in the fall, Biden at one point said publicly, we have put together the most extensive and thorough vote fraud operation in
mm-hmm.
history.
Yeah,
those are
confession.
Not. Yeah, I mean, what he meant was an anti-fraud. No, he meant he was trying to say that we're going to make sure that there's no vote fraud. But the mm-hmm. way he phrased it, and
mm-hmm.
it was just him being stupid again, was actually like a Freudian slip. I mean, they really did put together the most extensive vote fraud operation in history. And it's ironic that he said that, and, you know, it was a Freudian slip, and he really, in a sense, let the cat out of the bag, but, of course, no one followed up on it.
Oh, we've still got it there, and I remember that quote very well. Let me get Pianchi.
Yeah.
I've got, looks like Claire's on the line, too. So, sir, you're welcome to stick around for the rest of the show. We have a fascinating panel discussion. I don't know how much time you have, but, you know, we've got another hour, and I've played all the things I have to play as far as our sponsors go, so we can just kind of chat now. So it's wonderful
yeah,
to have you here. Sir, yeah,
I'd
go ahead,
like
John.
To stay for a little bit. I'd like to hear some Claire. I respect
okay.
her very much.
Well, good. So Claire, John Kwapitz is on the line. I got Pianchi on the line, too. Pianchi is one of our regular callers. Pianchi, why don't you join us first, then I'll bring Claire on.
Well, you know, one thing you remember, Harris calling Joe and saying, Joe, we did it. But this is all the standard reason why there needs to be a separate ballot
yeah.
for federal candidates separate of the state and local ballot. Because you just said that you're dealing with 50 different entities and there's no guarantee that they will or even want to do what is right.
Yeah.
You have to segregate that federal ballot. And
yeah.
Congress has the right to do so according to the Constitution. another point, and this is the last one.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's critical, one thing that's critical, Greg, is that we remember the faces and names of those who said there was no fraud when you said there was fraud, because they would come back again. Thank you.
No, yeah, stick around too, because I think this is going to get, you know, very interesting. I've been saying since November 4th that this was a fraud, that this was a total conspiracy, that once they shut down the election counting and the sabotage started, that this you can't believe a word of it, because Trump was ahead. The election ended about, you know, somewhere between 10 o'clock and midnight, you know, before the shutdown and the vote and the fraud votes came in. That was the election. Everything after that is just is a criminal conspiracy to literally overturn the election. What I wanted to say for John Kropitz, who's the first time on the show here, I don't know how much you know about Action Radio. So, but when Yankee's talking about a bill to separate the ballots, he wrote that bill. Okay. So what we do here that's never been done, that makes this such a wonderful experiment, that has brought some of the most incredible people like Jonathan and Claire to the show and Pianchi to the show, is that we write citizen legislation. We actually propose solutions, and we submit these bills to, well, in my case, Matt Gaetz, who's my congressman. I just sent him a rewrite, an improvement of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which I think is a much improved version. And I think Jonathan has an improvement on that. So that's what we do. So we talked about separating the ballots. That's what he means. Literally having federal and state ballots. We should talk about that right now, just on the concept of that, before you've even read the bill. Jen and John, I want to get your opinion, then I'll bring Claire on.
Yeah, I don't know all the details about that, but at first glance, mm-hmm. he mentioned something about how it's really we need to have a federal system, because there are all these different states doing all these different things. It's a problem. If you have it all centralized, the federal government totally in control, then what you have is an opportunity for total corruption around the whole mm-hmm. country. It can all, you know, it depends on who's running things. And if it's the bad guys are running the operation from federally, you can be in a much worse situation than you would have with the diversity that's what's going on around the country. And, of course, it's really not constitutional. It depends on what – how you are making a distinction in the ballots, but I don't see any real improvement in doing that. This whole H.R. 1 thing and John Lewis bill that's coming on following it in Congress is horrendous. It would end up permanently having the Democrats in control of the country because of the opportunity for fraud that they just opened the doors totally wide open.
Yeah, Pianchi had to leave right now, but what his bill does is it still everything in the states, just like we have now. But the ballots themselves would change. In other words, you would have a federal ballot and a state ballot, still with the states controlling the election. So that way you could track them better. And I don't have all the details myself. I'll have to read it. I'll send it to Jonathan, and we can take a look at it. But I want to bring Claire on the program too, Claire Lopez. And I watched your video again on Iran. It's fascinating what's happening here. If you talk about this, we've got John Kropitz on the line. And so let's do what we do best, which is, you know, take on the issues as they come up. Claire, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Greg, and everybody. Glad to be with you.
Yeah. Do you have a comment? John, why don't you go ahead, John Kropitz.
No. I was just saying hello. Claire and I have been on phone calls in the past, different organizations and calls, et cetera. So, and I'm familiar with her and very much respect her. Looking forward to hearing
questions.
Her.
Yeah, we've got a ton of questions as we go. Jonathan, did you want to follow up on anything in particular before we change things a little bit here? Have we covered this?
My day is bad, but I was hoping that, you know, over time, you know, John Kropitz may be able to help us recognize the, you know, why AOC and CRT and all these things are communism, you know, by the history of, you know, the revolution, you know, why they're trying to create this explosive, you know, he knows all the terminology from things, revolutionary force.
Yeah, Jonathan just cut out there. Go ahead, Jonathan.
What?
What did you say? You're cutting out again. And I'll talk to you about a microphone off the air after the show.
No, but, I don't know how that's possible.
Yeah.
But the thing is that there's a revolution, you know, the revolution is to create a revolutionary force, which the mm-hmm. communists don't really care what it is. They just want to create enough conflict to try to topple the existing order, and they'll use anything. And, you know, they will go into that. But anyway, so, and of course, Claire is, you know, understands these things too, and is telling us a lot of
things. It's cutting out again. Well, let's do it. Let's go that first then. John, if you want to expand on what Jonathan's asking, that'd be great. And then Claire can expand on that too.
I was just going to say that I think we could get into that another day and go into it in more detail.
Okay.
And,
well, you're our guest. What would you like to talk
about? Let Claire
go
ahead.
What should we, where should we go? And I'll get Claire's opinion. John? Okay. All right. Let's go to Claire then.
I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, John, because you're our guest here today, so I want to make sure that the issues that you think are most important, we can go right to. And then we can, like I say, I've got a ton of other questions for Claire and Jonathan as well.
Well, I do think it's going to be something over time that, like I said, I think that too much of what the left and the new left, which is basically radical communists who took over the Democrat Party in 1968 and such things, you know, they get away with a lot because our people don't know, you know, we don't recognize what they're doing. And I hope that at some point, you know, over the coming weeks, unless, you know, we can get to where the listeners can say, aha, I see what they're doing and why they're doing it. And so that's, I think, a long-term project I'd like to see if we can work on. So anyway, but we are in Claire's time, so. Yeah.
We share. Claire, how
Claire
close
knows
to
a lot
communism
about
are
this.
We? Go ahead, John, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say Claire knows a lot about this as well, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
But
Claire's a regular. She's on with Jonathan.
Yeah, and it's an
Jonathan
extended
Claire on every
thing.
Thursday. So we're there. In fact, John Kravitz, you're welcome to join us any Thursday. Feel free to be a part of our growing panel discussion here. So let me ask Claire, how close are we to what the communist, the leftist ideal? Where do they want to go with all this?
Well, we're getting pretty close. I couldn't agree more with what Jonathan said. They don't care what the issue is. The issue is never the issue. Race has been seized upon by the Marxists simply because Americans, for whatever reason, are absurdly sensitive about race, even though every single other civilization on the face of the earth has, and still is to this day, engaged in slavery, especially the Islamic countries. Under Islam, of course, slavery has never been banned or abolished. And so you've got slavery to this day in places like Sudan and Mauritania and Libya, the palaces of the Middle East, but nobody talks about that. But because Americans are so sensitive, and we're the ones who actually abolished slavery, the Marxists seized upon that as a wedge issue, as a divisive issue, because the issue of class, proletariat, you know, versus the bourgeoisie was not going to work in a place like America where the free market capitalist system offers so much opportunity to so many people. Mm-hmm. So they had to find something else, and that something else was race. And they're running with it, and too many people are letting them run with it. It's manifested itself in critical race theory, of course, running rampant through our schools and broader society. But again, it's not the issue. It's how do you set society into such turmoil and chaos that the conditions then would be ripe for revolution and overthrowing, you know, the existing system, which is the objective.
So I've got a question for you. I was thinking about as you're expanding on this, that there's both a class war and a race war, you know, in process here. And it seems to me the class war, the economic warfare, you know, we used to have a middle class back in the 50s. And I was watching, you know, America's Great Car Developers, those History Channel thing. And they were talking about in the 50s, you know, one income. In fact, one person running for Congress said that, I'd like to get back to a time when a family could support itself on one income, have a couple of cars, take vacations, you know, another parent could raise the kids, you know, and it was an interesting, you know, and the taxes were low enough, the government was small enough, and we actually had a huge middle class. And the warfare began with the Great Society under Johnson, you know, splitting black families with welfare and everything else, and then and the taxation, and then, you know, with feminism, with women, you know, having the ability to work, then became the duty to work. And now you have double taxation. You have both, you know, both parents, working parents, you know, working and paying taxes, and the kids are in daycare. So it seems to me that there is a class warfare going on, but the ideological war, the one that the Marxists, as you said, you know, were preying upon, was the race war. So so intellectually they're working on the race war, but they're actually working physically on a class war. What do you
think?
Well,
it's not a class war, because you don't have the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie, the haves versus the have-nots, to quote from Saul Alinsky.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do have is pure Marxist objectives, which, number one of which, I should say, is abolition of private property, right?
Right.
That's pure Marxism. It is do away with private property, and the way to do that, and this is spelled out in the Communist Manifesto, the way to do that is a heavy and a progressive confiscatory taxation system.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole tax the rich thing. All right, go ahead. Who's John? Do you
yeah.
want to jump in here?
If I may follow up with the race war thing and CRT.
Okay.
The communists, starting back in the early 20s when they got organized in the United States, have been working on the black community, has seen that the black community as a fertile ground for utilizing unrest and dissatisfaction to help build conflict and help build opposition to our society. But with the critical race theory and with the whole cultural Marxism development in the U.S., they've moved away from the idea of necessarily having war per se, civil war, so to speak. Okay. Although they would like, you know, they don't mind if they could do that, they'd be happy to do it. But within the critical race theory, there is the idea, well, in a broader sense, that they can win without having to go to war, that they can so infiltrate the institutions and so take over levers of power that they can gradually transform us, as Claire talked about it, the progressive taxation, all those things are part of the elements of doing such that. And with the critical race theory, the bottom line of critical race theory, and Kendi has openly said this, that basically they're saying that capitalism and, in effect, the Constitution are the reasons why we are a racist society.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cause of those two institutions. And they're irredeemable. They have to be overturned. We have to change to socialism and a new form of government. And they're pushing that idea politically. And so if they can get enough people to go along with that, and of course, you know, Obama, in effect, talked about the same thing, they're going to try to politically overturn things without having to go through actually a civil war. And, of course, they did. They have succeeded in a number of areas to do this, a number of countries, Venezuela being one, sadly. Yeah. And they go way back in history. Czechoslovakia was another one where the communists were able to gain power legally, and then they began to use different tactics to impose a tyranny on the country.
Interesting. This is like our discussions with Dr. Peter Pry, who's on Mondays, does our National Security Report, and we often talk about Sun Tzu and how China, you know, would be quite happy to take over the world without firing a shot, you know, particularly Taiwan, and we can get into that as well.
Yeah.
But I got Pianchi back online, and I want to ask a sort of a follow-up. You know, in other words, as someone who came, I was born in Canada, spent 4 years in Australia. I got the United States as a teenager. And so I'm looking at this country, and to me, race wasn't even a concept. I mean, yeah, I recognized, you know, like I recognize the sky is blue. I recognize that there are black people and white people and different colors in between. But it never made any sense. It never meant anything to me. So I walk into this country, and I'm looking around. I see Americans. I see black Americans, white Americans, you know, and all the hyphenated Americans, Irish, Italian, you know, wherever people came from, Asian, you know, and I'm looking at all this. But I see coming to this country as I see Americans. Okay. And I don't understand what's going on. It took me a long time to figure out just how ingrained this country is in terms of race. And so I know, you know, and then I learned history and slavery and something that I didn't talk about in Canada, Australia. It wasn't relevant to us. But what's interesting is that black Americans seem to have been targeted as the group that is most, I guess, useful to the revolution. for some reason, and I'm curious about Pianki's opinion on this too, but why is it just because it can't be just because of slavery, because we had, you know, Hispanic workers in the farm fields that were treated abysmally. We had, you know, Chinese railroad workers that were, you know, they were the ones that had to send the dynamite into the tunnels. You know, they always sent a Chinese person to do that. I mean, just these amazing things that were done to different groups. New York, the immigrants who came here, you know, Jews were treated terribly. Why blacks in America are singled out as the group most useful to the Marxists? And I'm going to ask John and Claire that question. John Kropitz, what do you think?
Well, because, I mean, they have had legitimate grievances, you know, over time.
Mm-hmm.
The Jim Crow laws, all sorts of things, even, you know, after we abolished slavery,
mm-hmm.
There was still a huge amount of conflict, not conflict, but oppression in one way or another that they experienced. And so there's a rich opportunity to work on those grievances over time and to kind of, you know, scratch that wound or that bite to infect it more. And it's a large body of people. It's, you know, the percentage of the population, it's a significant amount, number of people there. So they can have a significant impact ultimately. So that's part of it, I think.
Okay. But it seems that the Democrats have maintained the segregation, you know, from the earliest days of slavery. The Confederacy was a Democrat, you know, organization, Democrat Party. The KKK was from the Democrat Party. Jim Crow was a Democrat. And today we've got critical race theory separating people by Democrats. You know, it seems like they use this as their means of dividing. And is there any difference between the Democrats and the communists at this point? Let me bring Claire in the conversation, then we'll get to Pianki. Claire, am I on something here, or what do you think?
Yeah, basically the Democrat Party today is the Communist Party of the USA, although there also is a communist RevCom USA as well. The Democratic Socialists of America dominates the Democrat Party in America. It is the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. They use race because it works. Not because it's valid, because it works. And because it the reason it works is Antonio Gramsci's long march through the institutions in which, over the many decades past, generations of American students were taught to hate themselves and their own country and their own traditions and principles and founding principles and founding fathers and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the only people on the face of the earth who actually have allowed themselves to dislike themselves, to hate themselves more than anyone else. It's utterly absurd. But the example of socialism, you mentioned Venezuela. We've got Cuba disintegrating in front of our eyes,
mm-hmm.
and people in the streets down there clamoring for la libertad, liberty. They're not crying for more vaccines. They're crying for liberty and an end to communist oppression.
Yeah.
And somehow, still, individuals within the Democrat Party here, like AOC, for example, they see it. Of course they see it. They're lying. I mean, that's the bottom line. They're lying about it. They are openly sympathizing with the communist regime. Why? Because they want that turmoil and that collapse to happen here. Not because communism, or socialism as they sometimes call it, offers any kind of better opportunity for anyone. No, they're not looking for opportunity. They don't want things to be better. They want them to be worse. And so that's why they support what's going on, the clampdown by the regime in Cuba.
So the communists don't want, you know, their ideal society. They just want the power, and they don't care what it takes to get it.
Exactly.
And maintain it.
Look at any communist society on the face of the earth that's ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that the masses are disenfranchised. They're disarmed. They are impoverished. And a tiny sliver of elites, those who seize power at the barrel of a gun, Stalin, Lenin's Russia, Mao's China, Pol Pot's Cambodia, the Castro's Cuba, Chavez, Maduro's Venezuela, the tiny sliver of the elite who sees the power, the communists, they're millionaires.
Yeah.
They're multimillionaires, while the rest of society sinks further and further into poverty. That's what it's about. It's not about an economic system. It's about the seizure of power and privilege by a small elite at the cost of the entire rest of society. That's what communism really is.
Yeah. That's a perfect definition.
Allegedly,
yeah, thank you. John, go ahead.
Castro had $1 billion stashed away in Swiss banks when he died. I don't know how true that is. But, Claire is right, and this also goes to my point that the Democratic Party is really like a political mafia that wants to control everything and, become rich doing so and intimidate any opposition into silence. Okay. I wanted to mention another thing, if I can.
Oh, please.
Quickly here.
No, take
related
your time.
To the black issue and why they're so ripe, useful targets for, mobilizing and helping the communist cause. In effect, the Democrats, we went from the Jim Crow laws and all that. We finally got rid of that, but the Democrats still began to see that the black community. Well, they were interested in their votes, and so in the 60s, Lyndon Johnson, they put in the Great Society, they put in all the welfare programs that actually have tremendously hurt significant segments of the black community and have had the effect of keeping them in poor conditions, needing government assistance and being useful, therefore, to the Democrats politically. This was partly deliberate, and it's not just the welfare programs, it's also that the terrible schools and the school methodology, et cetera, that particularly exists in the ghetto areas, that in effect they have graduates coming out that are functionally illiterate, and fine, they can't get a job, they can't get ahead and get out of poverty, become more middle class, and maybe start to become Republican in their viewpoints, because they basically were never taught properly. But some of you may recall and may have heard that Lyndon Johnson, after the Great Society programs and things were enacted in a meeting at the White House, and this is on tape, he said, we'll have the N-word. We'll have them N-word voting for us for 200 years. Because they passed these programs. In effect, gain their allegiance and also keep them in a sense in poverty on the federal plantation to be useful to them. And by doing so, it also continued to provide the opportunity to the communists to work in the community, to use the discontent that was continuing because of the negative effect of these programs. To help utilize or develop the resentment and unrest in the black community.
Wow. Bianchi, you want to join in on this? Bianchi's back with us.
Well, critical race theory is many facets. And one facet that I recognize is that what they do is trying to throw guilt onto white people for all the ills. And the ills are only told in a slanted position. They want to throw guilt and make whites guilty, especially your children, because your children is future fuel for the plan today that should have died out in the black community, but it continues to be fuel. The fuel about the days. You are the day, Greg, Clara, John, you are the day. The days are dumbing down education. Well, the days don't have a damn thing to do with your education in your district. It's your responsibility as the law prescribes. They don't want to believe that. They're taught not to believe that. And I tell you something else. The church, and they want to separate. They don't want to separate. See, blacks are not all the same in this country. All blacks have experienced Jim Crow. All blacks were enslaved. But there's a mindset, a foresight that they want to keep them all together, whereas technically they want to leave. And I give you another example. If you have blacks that go to a white traditional school, that's taboo. If you have blacks that have degree in engineering. You can't go to work for IBM. You can't go to work for the CIA or FBI, because what you're doing is furthering white supremacy. That has been talked about. So it's very it's serious. Now, if with this critical race theory, when you're targeting the elementary schools and telling white kids that they are, that their parents have done a tremendous, terrible thing, and you know the funny thing about this, 30% of black male with bachelor degrees is marrying interracial. So now you got an interracial child. So you tell this child that your mother, your white mother, is a devil.
You know, it's interesting. We did a show on the census, and I talked about the coming white minority. And, of course, my contention is, so what? I mean, I loved it when I was in San Francisco, just because, you know, everybody was a minority. You couldn't claim, you know, minority status against the white oppressors, because, you know, white people in the Bay Area is like 25%. Like, you know, black is 25%, Asian 25%, and, you know, Hispanic 25%, with a little bit less than that, and about 5% sort of in there with everybody else. It was a fascinating place to live. And very different than where I am now in Florida. But a question for you, Pianki, then I want to go to John and Claire on this. And Jonathan, please feel free to join in the conversation as well. But with the rise of folks like Candace Owens, and I think I think Burgess Owens, I think it's the same last name, different people, you know, in Georgia, different black conservative leaders that are coming up now. Some of the younger black folks running for Congress. Do you see that black conservatism is just a huge threat to this whole ideology that's trying to be put on? And so they're now trying to, you know, emphasize white guilt as opposed to black victimhood. Do you see a pendulum shifting because of the rise of black conservatives?
Well, yeah. It is shifting, but it's shifting what I think is too slow. Candace, Ms. Owen is a very marvelous person because she speaks out on what she sees. I can talk the way I talk. You got a lot of blacks that's conservative, but they won't speak out because they'll be reprimanded. They'd be fired from their job. Somebody like me, they can't touch.
Yeah.
And also, I know the history and the tactics that's used. See, they tell a history. See, blacks said we want our history told, but your history is slanted.
Yeah.
See, you would march the white plantation owner out there on the stage. Well, what about the black plantation owner?
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln,
can you give me an
did
example?
Not free slaves.
Yeah. Is
well,
there like
there's
a black
plantation
owner
owners.
Today,
was,
like liberal
well,
black governments in liberal cities, for example? Is that what you're talking about?
They don't look at it like that. You got some cities that's been Democrat, like St. Louis, for 72 years, and look at it now. But what I'm talking about, that you got those out there that want to talk about history. They want to talk about slavery. They want to talk about how the white man has done this, that, and the other. But they don't bring out the black plantation owner, which there was plenty. So that's what they're trying to do, is throw the guilt onto young whites today, whereas they will feel guilty, even to the point where you see some videos of whites kissing the boot of some blacks.
Oh, yeah, the kneeling, the bow down, yeah. I have a sarcastic piece on that I made during the lockdown. We speak very openly here, so John, you know, like I say, feel free to be as controversial as you want. I mean, we do. And so especially on issues of race.
I'll tell you another reason how they've done it.
Discussions.
The word racism.
Okay.
The word racism. If I walked up to John and called him a racist, he would stop dead in his tracks.
Let's find out.
Rather than calling the black person a racist back.
Yeah. I did when I had the Black Lives Matter person on, you know, accused me of being a racist. It was hysterical. I let John and Claire, I don't know if you know the story either, but we had Walter, who does a show also on Blog Talk Radio, came on my show and actually sort of dared him to do it, but he ends up calling me a racist. And at the time, Pianki is on the line. Pianki's black. We had Josie, who's Nicaraguan. She's Hispanic. I was the only white person on the show. And so where is this racism you're talking about? And it was a fascinating discussion, but this is the wrong show to accuse me of being a racist. It just is. But John, welcome. Like I said, I'm really glad you're on the show today. What do you think about what Pianki's saying? I'm just curious.
Well, I think he makes a lot of good points. Definitely. Okay. What he's saying is valid, although he mentioned if he or someone were to call me a racist,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't stop dead in my tracks. First of all, I'd say that's BS,
yeah.
And I can give some examples about that in my life. And I would also point out, actually, that there are a lot of racists in the black community as well,
yeah.
And et cetera, et cetera. CRT promoting basically a racist mentality versus a Martin Luther King colorblind mentality.
He made
the mistake right there when he's trying to give an alibi for what he's done in his life. You don't have to give no alibi for what you've done in your life, even if you've done nothing. That is your concern. As long as you have not went out and violated the civil rights of a United States citizen, you know, racism really is legal. It's not illegal. Unless you violate a United States citizen civil rights. And one of the reasons why, because it's a ever-moving target. It evolves into something new every day. When I was coming up, when I was a child, and the things that is called racist today, I would not have recognized them then.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I love having Jackie on
baloney.
The show. Yeah. Claire, do you want to get back on this? And then I have some Cuba questions. Claire?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just sort of flabbergasted at how easily too many Americans are maneuvered into feeling guilt for something they've never done, for being born with innate characteristics just as anyone else. But this is, again, the long march through the institutions that deprived them of proper education about the greatness of America, of our system, of our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. And because they don't know those things, and because they're very weak-minded, I guess, they're easily manipulated. But it's amazing to see. You don't see this anywhere else in the world, where people so willingly are maneuvered into hating themselves. It's really astonishing to watch.
Well, this is probably, as someone who is Canadian, Australian, and then American, I don't feel it. I still don't feel it. I wasn't here, but that's not the point. The point is I don't accept white guilt. You start accusing me of something, I'm going to say, prove it. You know, what's your evidence? Let's go for there. I want to get to Cuba because it'd be an interesting segue. Cuba had slaves. I mean, I think Brazil had slaves. I don't know if Venezuela did. I think most of Central America had a slave-based economy at some point. Did the communists like Maduro and Castro, did they use race in their takeover of those places? Well, let's start with Cuba. Did the Castros use race as a wedge for their people, or was it all economic?
No, it was more economic. It was the power structure of the existing regime under Batista, of course. But going back to those years, the 1950s, before the revolution, Cuba was prosperous. Cuba was an amazing example of industry and production, and it will be again once it's free. But because it was ruled by a military regime, it was class that was used, and it was, tear down the regime, tear down the regime. Cuban people are amazing. I mean, they will flourish and thrive the moment they can throw off the communist yoke. And Cuba was well on its way. It's a very mixed society, of course. It's just as you say, there was slavery throughout the Caribbean and the Western Hemisphere, far worse than here in the United States. So they did not use, Castro did not use race. He used class and tear down the regime.
Interesting. I'll have to get Anthony back on the show. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, a further thing on the Cuban quote-unquote revolution. Castro also, in a number of ways, that revolution was a middle-class revolution because there was repression. You know, Batista had a petty repressive regime, civil rights, disagreement, et cetera. It was real repression of the people in terms of their viewpoints and et cetera, freedom of expression, what have you. And there was strong middle-class opposition to this this regime on that basis. And they, Castro was able to get a lot of middle-class people to support an effort to overthrow Batista. And these people didn't know to a large degree that what Castro was doing was actually promoting, seeking a communist takeover to impose a communist system. So a lot of middle-class people, because they were so opposed to the dictatorship of Batista, you know, joined in with Castro to overthrow him.
And then they lost their houses and
businesses, is,
right?
Yeah.
Then everything was nationalized, yeah.
Well, and for a long
time,
of course, the Castros denied that they were communists. They flat out lied. I mean, surprise, surprise, communists lied. And they told the people that they were not communist. I mean, the parallels are kind of eerie with the Iranian Revolution, you know, back in 1979, where the people, you know, rose up against, yes, a monarchy that was not democratic. But what they got then was far worse.
Yes, people don't think ahead to what can happen. You know, it's like, you know, come the revolution, things will be different. Well, not better, just different. This is like people forget that. John, go ahead, you have a comment.
You know, speaking of that, the author of the 1619 Project, I forget her name, but she was asked, you folks may have seen this, about race issues in South America or in the Central America and all that, in the Caribbean. And she said she couldn't speak too much. There was not so much of an issue in many countries, but she did say specifically that Cuba doesn't have a race problem, that Cuba has achieved equity, equality between the whites and blacks in Cuba. And I think she specifically said equity. And ironically, and she said it's because of socialism, you know, saying, oh, look what socialism has done. Okay.
Equity and misery.
That's exactly what it is. What happened, and she's right in what she said, but the truth of what she said is that everybody now is equally poor. They have you know, dragged everybody down and just made everybody miserable and impoverished because of socialism. It's such a tragedy, but that's what happens with a socialist communist government.
And again, that's exactly what communism is. Everybody, the masses of people, get to be equal in misery and poverty, and a tiny sliver of the elite who sees power at the barrel of a gun prosper and become multimillionaires. That's how it works. That's what communism really is.
Do you think, Claire, that they regret – I'm just going to one quick question, and then I'll get to you. Do you think that the Cubans regret not rebelling under Trump? Because I think they have a very different response. Claire?
Oh, you mean having risen up sooner, I see.
Yes, yes.
I've not heard that. I've not heard that. Perhaps they do. Perhaps I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Why now then?
I'm
was there an event
to...
that sparked this? Oh, John, go ahead. Yes, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah, I'm just going to say I'm going to have to cut off, move on now, but I thank you for the opportunity to be on and enjoyed the conversation, and hopefully be talking with you folks later another day.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And Thursday we do this, so you're welcome anytime. You don't need an invitation. Just, you know, feel free to join us. I'll be more than happy to have you on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye now. John Kravitz, hope I pronounced his name correctly. New to me. Yes, this has been fascinating. Jonathan, thank you so much for bringing him on. Claire, just a quick question on Cuba, then I want to get to Middle East and Japan and China before we're done. What sparked this you know, cry for liberty at this particular time? Was there an event? Was it just kind of brewing? And like I said,
I don't think it was any particular event. I think it was more kind of reaching critical mass of misery and poverty and oppression.
Was there less oppression under Trump because of what Trump might have done to Cuba?
Blockades,
economic sanctions, they didn't care?
Worse and worse.
Okay. Well, let's switch to random. Bianchi had a point. I'm sorry. Bianchi, go ahead. I forgot your – yeah. Bianchi?
Well, I was going to talk to John about the separate ballot since he said he didn't think it would work. I think people come to that conclusion because they don't really give it a good, thorough thinking how it would work. But let Claire go on to the other topics. The
I'll see if I can – I'll get Jonathan to share the bill with John because I don't have a means of transmitting it to him. But that's something we should definitely talk about because it's a good idea. So back to, I guess, Iran. I saw your video. We've got a horrible person there who was picked, I guess, specifically because he's a mass murderer, and he's got what the mullahs are looking for to sort of stop any kind of freedom coming out of Iran. What's going on with the people there? I'm just curious. Claire.
Well, so in the selections, as we call them, back in May this year, 2021, the clear choice of the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the clear choice, Ibrahim Raisi, who had been the chief prosecutor of Iran and came up through the judiciary, the ranks of the judiciary, not typically politics or the clergy. He was not a cleric. But Ibrahim Raisi was selected to be the next president. He'll take office in August, in just a couple of weeks from now, he is someone with the blood of thousands and thousands and thousands of Iranians on his hands, which, of course, is the reason that he was picked. Some point to him as a potential successor to the supreme leader, Khamenei, who's on up in years and not in such great health. In particular, Raisi is noted for having been a member of what they call the death panel or the death committee back in 1988 as Iran, under then still the Ayatollah Khomeini, who didn't die until 1988, Iran, you'll recall, ended the war with Iraq, with Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which had raged for a decade or so, with hundreds of thousands of deaths, maybe a million total on both sides. And Khomeini finally said something to the effect that he will drink the poison chalice, and accepted a ceasefire. But as the war ended, and as the reason or the mechanism by which the regime could project the people's attention, outwards, against an outward enemy, against an external enemy, as that was now ending, Khomeini realized that the many internal enemies of the regime, the opposition, in particular the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, National Council of Resistance of Iran, well, at that time, it was only the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. NCRI developed later as the umbrella group. But the MEK, there were tens and tens of thousands of MEK in Khomeini's jails. And he realized that once the focus of the Iranian people's attention ended against Iraq and Saddam Hussein, that it was going to turn inwards once again, and that the danger then existed for internal unrest. And so what happened is that Khomeini ordered the massacre of as many as 30,000 prisoners in the jails as they were exiting the war. Many of those prisoners, as I said, were MEK. A whole bunch of them were teenagers. And a whole bunch of them, the girls, were raped before they were murdered because under Islam, the belief is that if an unmarried young girl is raped, she will be unclean and unable to enter paradise. This is what they believe. So they raped them.
Yeah, because we never really talked about that, but rape seems to be...
He was on the member of the committee that sent them all to their deaths.
Wow. I want to talk about him in a second. But just now that I think about it, we've never really talked about this, but it seems like, you know, when you have Muslim refugees or illegal folks just crossing border, or even legal, you know, crossing into a lot of the European countries, I mean, Sweden in particular, you know, sexual assaults and rapes are huge. And I've always wondered why, but it sort of makes sense that is part of the culture. That is almost like a weapon against whatever culture, European culture they're in. Is
well,
that what they're thinking?
It's license that they are permitted. I mean, it's in the Quran. I mean, it's immutable. It's part of Islamic doctrine that Muslim men are permitted to rape as many girls as they want. They're limited to only four wives, but they may have as many concubines or sex slaves as they like and as they can get their hands on in warfare
right.
or any other way. And that's doctrine. That's Islamic doctrine. It's core Islamic belief.
Interesting. And so the rape of an infidel, you know, a non-Muslim would be even, I don't know, what's that, even
right.
not even consequential
here,
or what?
Talking about is the rape of Iranian girls, Muslim Iranian girls, by
uh-huh.
their Muslim jailers. But again, because the belief was that if they were raped,
you know, unmarried girls, they would not be allowed to enter paradise.
Wow. Let's get back to this, you know, bastard that's running or we're trying to run Iran right now. He kills 30,000 students. How did, I hate to be morbid about this, but how did they actually do this? Was this like a, you know, is there a mass grave? Did they
That's
have like a mass shooting?
Of firing squads and others were hung.
Wow. And this didn't seem to make the news very much. Now, how long, this is back in the 80s you're saying this happened, or how long ago was this?
88, prison massacre. As a matter of fact, the reason that the designated successor at that time to Khomeini,
uh-huh.
the Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, the reason that he got bumped and sent to house arrest and did not succeed Khomeini
mm-hmm.
was because he objected to the prison massacre.
Oh,
and instead, the current supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who, by the way, wasn't even an Ayatollah, he was only a Hujjat al-Islam, and they artificially bumped him up so he could be supreme leader at the last moment.
Okay.
When Montazeri was knocked out of the succession, they had to find somebody else. And so the current supreme leader, Khamenei, was picked because he was compliant and he was, you know, the compromise choice, I guess.
Hmm.
It was under Khamenei now, since that time, that the Iranian nuclear program, by the way, the nuclear weapons program, advanced far and so rapidly.
Wow. And so, Obama comes to mind as being complicit. Well, obviously, he was the one that pushed the deal. John Kerry's there all the time. John Kerry was there when Trump was president, saying, don't listen to Trump. He's not really the president. You know, all the stuff that Kerry was doing. They obviously knew about this massacre, and they know the character of the people that they're dealing with. I guess Obama and Kerry don't care?
No, they don't care at all.
Okay.
They want Iran, this Iranian regime, to get the nuclear bomb. They want it to go nuclear. They'll
mm-hmm.
never say so, but that's what they want, because
okay.
they want Iran to be the hegemon of the region, to dominate the Sunni neighbors who have become our partners and the partners of Israel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They want an Iranian regime that will be able to threaten Israel with nuclear weapons. These are the things they want. They're never going to say so, but that's what they actually want, and it is why they
know, though. Yeah.
The regime. It's why they support trying to get back into a deal, because they know that a nuclear deal, a JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, would be a glide path, as former Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu called it, a glide path to a nuclear weapon for Iran. They know that, and that's what they want.
Yeah. So it's amazing the lack of journalists, you know, integrity to actually report that as plainly and clearly as you said it. That's why I'm glad you're saying it here. So we need to get our show shared a lot more, so this kind of information does get out. I'm thinking the way this is, well, the Abraham Accords, that's what I wanted to ask you about. The countries that made the alliances under Trump, you know, the folks that were making alliances with Israel, are they still working behind the scenes to keep those alliances? Are they working against
yes,
Iran?
Yes, they
are. Are they getting support? Okay, good.
For our Bahrain, United
okay.
Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco. And although more countries joining was kind of, you know, knocked off track with
mm-hmm.
The accession of the Biden administration to the White House, the four that are, you know, initially signed, that continues. And, I mean, the most amazing things are taking place, not just the exchange of ambassadors and the location of embassies in each other's capitals, that's going
mm-hmm.
forward, you know, but things like the sale of kosher food, kosher restaurants in these Middle East countries,
oh, wow.
Gulf countries like the United Arab Emirates, just the most amazing things. That is
That's
still
incredible.
Going forward. And the reason it's going forward
mm-hmm.
is because it was always in the interests of those involved. And this is what
okay.
Bibi Netanyahu understood. It's what Donald Trump understood, that
mm-hmm.
this works these accords work and will continue because it's in their interest that it do so. Not about the United States, although we're very happy to see the Abraham Accords be successful, yeah. But it's because the participants are finding it useful. The exchange of technology. I mean, you know, Israel is not a threat to any of them. They know that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a source of all kinds of opportunities for the exchange of things like agricultural technology, medical technology, water technology.
Yeah, desalination. I was just thinking of that, yeah.
Desalinization,
yeah.
Sure.
That's how,
you know,
yeah.
This is places like Jordan, landlocked, receive a huge amount of water every year from Israel. I don't think people know that. Gaza depends on Israel for its water and electricity and all kinds of other.
So they could cut that off at any time, right? I guess Israel could cut that off if things
get
bad.
They could, but they won't.
Now.
I mean, because yeah. Jewish people are humanitarian people. They're not going to
yeah.
do that.
Yeah. I got about 4 minutes left. I want to ask you election fraud. We're watching it closely here on this show all the time, every day. I do a special report on Wednesdays. How much is the rest of the world watching what's happening in Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania? And are they sort of gearing like a two-pronged strategy, one if Trump gets back in office and one if Biden stays for the rest of the term? How is the rest of the world viewing what we're doing here with our own election correction?
Well, the number one word I would use would be horror. I have friends in other places around the world, and they are absolutely horrified at what we're doing to ourselves.
Okay.
They realize that our elections were fraught with fraud and corruption. They know that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're watching, you know, the audits and so forth. But they're appalled, as we can see the Cubans are very vocally, for example. They're appalled that the beacon of liberty in the world that the United States has been to all of them is faltering. They look to us to be the leader of the free world, to be that beacon of liberty for the world. And the fact that we are collapsing into a communist revolution of our own absolutely horrifies and appalls them.
Interesting. Are they, you know, hoping for a different outcome? Or are they hoping for the election correction, as I call it? Or are they just, but still hunkering down just in case, you know, this gets worse? Are they have different strategies for different outcomes? How different, like China, I know they're watching this, Iran, I know they're watching this, different Middle East countries, different places around the world. I mean, you just pick a country. We've got about a little over 2 minutes left. I'm just curious what they're thinking, what they're looking at. Is England looking at this, for example?
Well, I mean, they don't necessarily understand the intricacies of U.S. election procedure, and of course, nothing's going to be overturned. It can't. There's no congressional or legal remedy for the overturn of an election. It's not going to happen.
Okay.
But what they do want to see is that rule of law is reestablished here. That's what they're looking for.
We got about 2 minutes left. Jonathan or Bianca, you guys are both still on the line. Do you have a question for Claire? Anybody want to jump in here?
Well, I have a question she probably can't answer in the 2 minutes that we have.
Yeah.
That we have left. But in terms of now I forgot it. I've been waiting for that. But you know, I'm maybe I'll pass Bianchi.
Here's the thing too. I mean, you can leap in the conversation. I mean, I tend to monopolize things. I'm sort of like, you know, if there's a vacuum, I'm going to fill it. So if you want to say something, just jump in and say, Greg, I got a point to make. And it's like, okay. So and
well,
otherwise,
I didn't want to interfere with her
okay.
saying these things. But
I kind of like it when you do. So feel free to interfere. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I know what I was going to say. Yesterday, a donor to Trump was indicted, arrested, for supposedly representing the United Arab Emirates in their interests to the Trump administration. And what you were just describing, you probably have to look into this, probably all have to, is
yeah.
that recommending why it would be good for the United States to do everything that you were just describing and more, the Arab Accords, I don't see how that is representing the UAE instead of recommending solutions to all the enduring problems of the Middle East. So I think that'd be very interesting.
Nothing wrong with being a legal representative of another country so long as you declare it, so long as you comply with federal regulations.
But,
and apparently that's what
the question
person
is
not do.
That's what he's accused of. But the question is he proposing solutions of this tangled problem in the Middle East for the Trump administration when he's in it, or is he doing something exclusively for UAE for UAE's benefit? That I think will be an interesting, you know, because what Trump did is revolutionary in the Abraham Accords and everything like that. So it'll be, I think, very interesting to try to figure that out.
Yeah, we're out of time, so we can't take it up this time. But you guys can talk during the week, and we can do it next time. Go ahead, Claire.
It's not the substance of his representation. It's the fact that he did not comply with FARA, foreign asset, foreign agent. What is it? Foreign agent
registration act. Yeah.
Yeah, that.
Registration
Act.
Wow. Let's take that up next time, too. Thank you all very much, Pianki. Thank you, Jonathan, for bringing John on the show, Claire. And let's do it again next week. This is Greg Fengles for Action Radio, blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. You never know what's going to happen here because I never know what's going to happen here. That's what makes it so much fun. You can support us at patreon.com/actionradio, and you can listen to us in your vehicle by putting Action Radio in your cell phone, plug it into your car audio, and away you go. Back tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock.